Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which brews beers that are highly rated by beer critics and beer lovers alike. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions, and that is the unmistakable sound of our guest this week, trumpet player Herb Alpert. I mean, Greg, this is a resume that is unparalleled in the history of music. All those 60s hits with the Tijuana Brass, Lonely Bull, Whipped Cream, you know, his version of A Taste of Honey. He is a songwriter, he's a producer, he co-founded one of the coolest major labels when those things were still cool, A&M Records, with Jerry Moss. He, of course, was the A, and Moss was the M. Signed the Carpenters, Cat Stevens, The Police, Janet Jackson. He's given a lot of money to really worthy causes. In his spare time, he's a sculptor who's shown his art around the world.
And at age 81, Jim, he is still touring and recording. He's cranking out new albums regularly. The latest is called Human Nature. Herb Alpert, it is an honor to welcome you to Sound Opinions.
Well, thanks so much. I'm glad to be with you guys.
So, Herb, tell us how you got your start in the music business. I mean, what a story it's been, right?
I started, you know, working as a songwriter. I was partners with Lou Adler, and we wrote some songs with Sam Cooke, and then, you know, we wrote Wonderful World with Sam. And then Sam was a great mentor. He was, he didn't know he was teaching, but, you know, he'd look at me and say, Herbie, you know, we're looking for a cold piece of wax, and it just makes it, it either makes it or it don't, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So he was from the field school, you know, and that was a big aha for me.
Don't know much about history, don't know much biology, don't know much about a science book, don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
The field school, that's an interesting note about Sam Cooke. In other words, the emotion had to be there. No matter how much technology was involved, the emotional element had to be there. I take from that, right?
Well, that was the only thing that had to be there. I mean, Sam was a gospel singer. He came out of the gospel field. He was the lead singer with the Soul Stirrers. And when I met him, he was just, he was an amazing artist. I can't say no more. He was a gentleman and an amazing artist. He'd carry around a folder, and he had these, write some poetry, write some lyrics. He showed me these lyrics, and I looked at these lyrics, and I said to myself, I was thinking to myself, man, this is really corny. I said, what does the song sound like? He picked up his guitar, and all of a sudden he transformed these lyrics into something really beautiful. You know, I said, that's it. It's all about the feel, where you put the notes, the space in between the notes, the melody. And, you know, that was a big lesson for me.
I think we have to start, as any story with you has to start, with that chance trip to Tijuana, and you hear a mariachi band, and the Lonely Bull comes out of it. So take us through the earliest Tijuana Brass, the Lonely Bull, that incredible success.
Yeah, it wasn't one chance trip. It was, you know, a couple seasons I used to go to Tijuana and watch the bullfights. And I never heard mariachi music, but there was a brass band in the stands that introduced each event, you know, like when the bull would come out or before the bull would come out, you'd hear this brass band go, and then the bull would charge out. And it was quite exciting for the first, I guess I was there for three seasons. And then I kind of got turned off by bullfighting, because the last time I went, I saw a bull gore the horse.
Ooh.
And, you know, that was just not a pretty sight. And I just thought, man, this is not for me anymore. At any rate, I was enamored by that feeling of those afternoons. I tried to, you know, do something that would reflect that feeling with a song. And that's how The Lonely Bull came out. And The Lonely Bull melody was totally different when I heard it. It was written by a friend of mine, and he wrote it like a music box. So it was like very high-pitched demo that he made. Do 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 do, you know, coming out of a music box. And I liked that melody, so I kind of, you know, put my own stamp on it and changed a little bit of the bridge. I played it for a disc jockey friend of mine, and he said, where's the hook? I said, what are you talking about, the hook? He says, no, you need a hook. I said, man, this is an instrumental record. Mm-hmm. There's no hook. Yeah, you need a hook, man. So, you know, I thought about that, and I called a friend of mine at Liberty Records who had happened to have a tape with 30,000 people screaming Olé. Mm-hmm. And I put that right in front with the after the fanfare, while the fanfare was going on, right in the front. That was the hook. And that record took off like a rocket once we put it out.
Now, there was actually no Tijuana Brass band at this point, right? I mean, you recorded with the Wrecking Crew, the session musicians.
Yeah, exactly. And there was no Tijuana Brass band until after the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. Mm. Yeah, I just used the musicians of my choice. They actually didn't play on the Lonely Bull. That was, you know, like the drummer from the Ventures played drums on that. I played piano and did some voices behind and some percussion. You know, that whole thing was recorded for like $300.
That you put up yourself, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we put up ourselves. You know, Jerry and I started, we had a record called Tell It to the Birds that I was singing on. And this is before A&M. It was on a label called Carnival Records.
You turn me on and you put me down.
We had this record, we released it locally, and in San Francisco and L.A., the record kind of did rather well, so we turned it over for distribution to Dot Records, and we got, I think, $700 plus a percentage, and with that money, we recorded The Lonely Bull.
And we should explain that the M is Jerry Moss, your partner.
In A&M.
For you.
Yeah, Jerry Moss, my partner of... so many years now. I mean, we started A&M Records. This is a beautiful part of the story. Is we started this company on a handshake in my garage. We never signed any agreement, anything that resembled a serious agreement until we sold the company in 1990. Mm. And it was a beautiful experience because I was in partners with a wonderful gentleman and honest gentleman. And when we signed to sell the company, we hugged each other, and that was it. You know, we did this company that was pretty darn successful on a handshake.
The whole idea of A&M starting this label with no money, did you first try to get somebody else to put out The Lonely Bull for you, or did you just have this notion from the start with your partner Jerry Moss that, hey, we're going to do this ourselves?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of little labels. In 1962, labels were rampant. You know, people were operating out of the trunks of their car. There was no office. So if you had a good master and you took it up to a radio station in those days and the program director happened to like it, you know, they'd either put it on the air immediately or wait for the next meeting. And then, you know, it was like that type of thing. So we just thought we were putting out a record. We weren't thinking of starting a record company. Just we wanted to put out a single record and see what would happen. And when The Lonely Bull took off, you know, we got a lot of feedback from distributors that said, well, hey, man, why don't you guys just take the money and run? Mm-hmm. And we thought, that's fodder for let's see if we can hang on to this for a little while. And that's what we decided to do. You know, once that door opens for you, it's really, you need that momentum. Mm-hmm. I remember getting a call from our distributor in Washington, D.C., who said, man, you guys got a smash. And this was like about 2 weeks after the record was released. He says, that Acapulco 1922 is a monster. I said, man, you are on the wrong side. You know, they were playing the other side, and it was a smash.
What could have been perceived as sort of a novelty record, you know, with the sound effects, and you turned that into a sound. Was it sort of a serendipitous that that happened, or did you sort of see a way that this was going to translate into sort of the start of your career on a broader basis?
Well, you know, I didn't even think like that. I thought that, you know, a lot of times in those days especially, you'd hear a hit record, and then you'd hear the same artist for the second release, you know, do something very similar. I didn't want to do this Lonely Bull sideways. I wanted to see how far I could take it. I wasn't thinking about, you know, how much money I could make or how popular I might be. I just wanted to make nice records, so that was my pursuit. And it took a while, you know, after the Lonely Bull album, which was a big success. We put out the second album, Tijuana Brass Volume 2. Didn't do so well. But I've still hung on to that sound. I mean, I just took songs that I felt were worthy of recording, and I had a good time in the studio. And then I recorded the album South of the Border. That was the third album. And while I was mixing it, I was at Radio Recorders mixing it. This was late at night, and this maintenance lady was cleaning up the studios, and she knocked on the door, and she said, "What's that playing?" I said, "Well, it's the Tijuana Brass." She says, "I really love it, you know." Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I thought, whoa, I think we're onto something here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In that album, we had Mexican Shuffle, which the Clark D. Berry Gum Company took as a national song for their PR program. And I think that thing kind of pointed the way for the sound of the Tijuana Brass.
It sort of became, the Tijuana Brass became an aesthetic, you know. I mean, you performed the main theme for Casino Royale, and then there was the Dating Game music. You know, there was this hip, pan-cultural kind of, you know, living life large, drinking tequila, playing that horn, and of course, the cover for Whipped Cream and Other Delights. Herb, did you know when you first saw it, I imagine, was it your idea? Did somebody bring you an artist proof? Did you know, like, this is going to be an iconic album cover of all time?
Well, not only did I not know that, I didn't think that was an appropriate album. I thought it was a little too racy, to tell you the truth. I was in the studio recording the Whipped Cream album, and Peter Worf was our head of graphics. He designed that idea, and when he showed it to me, I was in the studio, and I wasn't sure it reflected what I had musically. My partner, Jerry, you know, loved it. He thought it was, you know, racy and a little edgy at the time. Right now, it doesn't even qualify for being edgy, but it was, you know, special at that particular moment in history. And I went along with it, and it certainly became an iconic cover. I'll tell you something that happened, and this, man, I'm not making this up. This happened like about 3 months after this album was released. This guy comes up to me, and he says, "Mr. Albert, do you know that Whipped Cream cover?" I said, "Yeah." Well, she says, I just can't get it. I love it, man. It's so beautiful. I said, "Well, thank you so much. What do you think of the album itself?" He says, "Well, I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet." And man, and this was 3 months after it was released.
The record, though, is an interesting album. It did have sort of a concept to it. There was a sort of a food theme in at least the album titles. Tell us a little bit about your thinking in making the music for an album that really proved to be a huge breakthrough for you.
Well, you know, we kind of backed into it. I got a call from our distributor prior to recording the album. I got a call from our distributor in New Orleans, and he said he just heard a song that Al Hurt had turned down. And he thought I might like it. So he played it for me over the phone. And I loved it. I said, would you please send it to me? And that turned out to be, you know, Whipped Cream. That was the song that, you know, started the whole thing. After that record, you know, became a moderate success, Jerry said, let's get an album filled with food titles and call it Whipped Cream and Other Delights. And that was the brilliance of, you know, Jerry's move there. And, you know, within that album had the biggie, A Taste of Honey, which was a whole other story. Because when I finally got the group together, we had released a single and Taste of Honey was on the B-side. Third Man Theme was the song that Jerry was pushing. We were playing in Seattle, Washington, and every time I played Taste of Honey, the people went crazy. I mean, they loved it. There was something about it that, you know, really touched. And sometimes I played it twice in a row. So I called Jerry from Seattle. I said, Jerry, look, you're on the wrong side. It's Taste of Honey. He says, no, man, you can't dance to the thing. And it's too long, and it stops in the middle a couple times, and it starts and stops. And I said, I don't know about that, but look, there's a focus group up here. And I think Taste of Honey is the one. So we finally turned it over. And Taste of Honey was the one that really, really opened the door for the Tijuana Brass, because after that record hit, people started buying, you know, The Lonely Bull again and the second album and South of the Border. We got on Ed Sullivan and Dean Martin and all the big shows. That was the, you know, the song that really, really did it for us.
After a short break, we'll talk to Herb Alpert about his career as the co-founder of A&M Records. And later, we're going to review the 16th studio album from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.